I've been, I come to the United States about 3 times a year, primarily to go to college campuses to speak to college age and graduate school age students in my effort to, you know, help with the revival of interest in Torah Judaism. And normally I would start off with a story or a joke or whatever, because, you know, I find it's great for warming up an audience. But at Lunch and Learns, I'm very careful to try to not keep people beyond the time of the class. So I'm just going to go straight to the content. You'll have to excuse me for that, because I want to make sure that I can stick to my time so that I don't hold anybody over. Basically, the big issue that faces college-age students and faces everyone in this room at some point in their lives is the question, the Jewish issue of whether God gave Torah to the Jewish people at Mount Sinai, or whether or not the Torah is a man-made collection of, you know, different works by different people over time, and it was edited together at some point in history, and the final version is the version we have now called the Five Books of Moses. Now, Orthodox Judaism claims that it is a God-given text at Mount Sinai. It is not man-made. And that, of course, has a lot of implications. If it is God-given, of course, then it has great insights as to how I should lead my life, ethically, morally, in terms of observances, and so on and so forth. If it's man-made, of course, it may be culturally interesting, it may be historically nice, it may be full of inspiring stories, but it can't obligate me to do anything, because men who lived 3,000 years ago cannot tell me what to do today, even though they may have some nice insights. The Reform movement in Germany in the 1820s, when it was founded, adopted the position that it was a man-made text. The conservative movement was founded in Germany in the 1840s, about 20 years later, and they did not adopt that position originally. But in the last 20 or 30 years or so, they have shifted toward that position as well, which leaves, out of about 14 million Jews on the planet, probably as many as 13 million of them, maybe even more than that, probably would have the mindset that the Torah is not God-given in Mount Sinai. It is a man-made text by various people and edited together. The best way to deal with that issue, of course, is with the opportunity to learn the Torah deeply, because obviously it's not going to show its depth in its English translation, or any translation for that matter, because the Hebrew doesn't translate well into other languages. However, most people don't have the opportunity or the time to go to a yeshiva or a seminary or something like that for a few months, build the skills to actually examine the text in its original Hebrew and to see its depth. The top mitzvah out of the 613 mitzvahs is to learn Torah, because I think that the Almighty is confident that anyone who can sit down and learn the Torah in depth will see that it is God-given. It's way too deep to be man-made. The deeper you go, the deeper it gets. But you really need time to explore that depth. So what do people do if they don't have time to do something like that? So that's why I try to do these classes based on the mystical Hebrew alphabet, because I think that in an hour, I might be able to give you a glimpse, or at least get people thinking, that maybe this text is more than man-made. And the reason is because when the Almighty designed Torah-based Hebrew, he designed it on a basis that makes it dissimilar from every other language on the planet. In all other languages, letters have no meaning. They're just shapes which represent sounds. So if I write the word cat on the board, a C doesn't mean anything, an A doesn't mean anything, and a T doesn't mean anything, and the sum total of these three letters teaches me nothing about the nature of a cat. However, when the Almighty designed Torah Hebrew, and none of what we're going to do today applies to modern Hebrew. Modern Hebrew has no mystical or Torah significance to it. It was largely founded. The original dictionary, I think, was done at the turn of the previous century by a man named Ben Yehuda. The words that he borrowed from the Torah, of course, would have significance, but there are plenty of made-up words in modern Hebrew. So when the Almighty designed the Hebrew alphabet, he designed it so that each letter is really a philosophical idea. Torah Hebrew has each letter being a concept. An aleph means something, a bet means something, a gimel means something. And therefore, interestingly enough, when the Almighty takes these concepts and brings them together to create a word, so the deeper meaning of that word, or what that word represents, will be the sum total of the meanings of the letters, right? So for the next hour, what I want you to do is, instead of thinking of these as letters of Hebrew alphabet, let's pretend they're Lego blocks, the children's toy, right? And each Lego block is a different shape, and each Lego block is a different meaning. What the Almighty's going to do is gather together different concepts, different meanings, different philosophical ideas, click them together, and that's going to become the thing. That's why the first 6 days of creation don't say that God zapped reality into existence. It doesn't say that God thought reality into existence. It said God said, let there be. But he doesn't have a mouth. There's no one to talk to. The answer is, mystically speaking, he's taking concepts, clicking them together, and that's crystallizing into reality. That's why the Hebrew word for a word is a devar Torah. You know, you hear somebody say, I'm going to give a devar Torah. So the word for a word is a devar. The word for a thing is a devar. Because everything becomes an expression of the Almighty's word. That's how reality is being generated according to the Torah. So what we're going to do this morning is just explore the first letter of the alphabet and see if we can understand what's the philosophical concept behind the letter Aleph. Aleph being the first letter of the alphabet, Aleph is spelled Aleph Lamed Fei. It's a combination of these three letters, Aleph, and it has a mathematical value of 1. A gematria of 1, and therefore any letter which represents oneness in Judaism has to allude to God, right? Because that's infinite oneness, infinite perfection. So somehow this letter is going to teach me something about godliness. Now obviously the shape itself can't have to do with God because that would be idolatrous. You're not allowed to represent God with shapes in Judaism. But there must be some message in this shape of something the Almighty wants me to know because it is the letter that represents his oneness. Now we're going to look for hints in the letter Aleph to see if we can find some that send some sort of message. The first hint is that, unlike the rest of the alphabet, Aleph is the only silent letter. All the other letters of the alphabet have a physical sound associated with them. Aleph, which represents God's oneness, has no physical sound associated with it, because the Almighty, just like he doesn't give himself a physical expression out into the world, so too he doesn't assign a physical sound to the letter Aleph. Many people think that Ayin is a silent letter. That's a flaw in modern Hebrew. The Jews from Teman, who have a much more accurate Hebrew, actually pronounce an Ayin as a guttural sound. So Aleph is really the only silent letter of the alphabet. That's hint number one. Number two is that when the Almighty uses these three letters, an Aleph, a Lamed, and a Fe, here, when the Almighty uses the word Aleph in other contexts, not as the noun that represents the first letter of the alphabet, but when he uses it, let's say, as a verb, I noticed that there are Israelis in the room. What does it mean to aleph something as a verb? Lalef means, so the Israelis are going to say train, right? Is that right? Yeah. Okay, so in the Torah, actually, it's very similar. In the Torah, the word alephing something as a verb really means to educate it. That's why, just for fun, let's see if we can do this here. That's why it happens to be the root of the word ulpan, a place where you go to learn Hebrew, right? So alephing means to educate. What's the idea of education? Education means taking something in low potential and raising it to a higher level. You take an 18-year-old with no job skills, 4 years later they're an accountant, right? That's called, education is always low potential raised to a higher level. Remember this, because in exactly 59 minutes when this class ends, you'll see taking something in low potential, raising it to a higher level will be the theme of an aleph. So we'll look for other examples of, that's education. Look at other words the Almighty uses with the word Aleph. For example, when we have the numbering system, the alphabet here, you see the ones places, the tens places, the hundreds places. When I get to oneness at the next highest level, beyond this numbering system, I get to, after ones, tens, and hundreds, go back to second grade, thousands, right? And the word for thousands is Aleph, it's the same word. In other words, I took my numbering system and I pushed to the next highest level. Or, for example, the Torah tracks the leaders of the nations that descend from Esau. Esau, or in Hebrew his name is Esau, was Jacob's twin brother. He was evil. And the Torah is very careful to tell you who the leaders of the nations were that descended from him. Normally, the Torah doesn't track descendants of people so much, but the Almighty, I think, focuses on Esau because his descendants give rise to the Roman Empire. And the subsequent Roman exile, the Roman Empire transitions to the Christian Empire, and we have 2,000 years of exile from Esau's descendants, so the Almighty is very careful to see who are the descendants of Esau. The descendants of the leader of the nations, from the Torah standpoint, the word used to describe a leader of a nation, somebody who elevates himself up to lead everybody else, is the word aluf. And in modern Hebrew, they kept this word from the Torah because in the Israeli army, an aloof is somebody who lifts himself up to lead everybody else. It's like a colonel or a general or something like that in the army, right? So aloof means somebody who raises himself up to lead everybody else. That's why the modern English word to be aloof, where you think you're better than everybody else, is going to come from this Torah word right here. So you see, aloofing takes something low potential, raises it to a higher level. That's the theme over and over again. Now, you have to ask the question, if the Almighty wanted to design a letter that represents his oneness, so why didn't he use a simpler shape? If I were God's graphic artist, and I were designing a letter representing oneness, so I'd use a vertical line, in Chinese a one is horizontal, maybe a circle is more unified, maybe a dot, all the, but why an X? An X-like pattern is a very strange shape to represent oneness. So what we have to do basically is pull out our microscope here and analyze the components of an aleph, and if we look very carefully, we'll see that an aleph is really a combination of other letters. It's not one letter in and of itself. Can anyone spot the component letters of an aleph?
Gimel.
Yeah, it looks like it actually, but if I do this, maybe it makes it a little more helpful.
Yud.
Yeah, it's got an upper yud, it's got a lower yud, and it's got a slanted vav. So really, the aleph as it's written in the Torah is a combination of three letters, not a letter in and of itself. So the question is, why did the Almighty do that? Why couldn't he have designed a shape for the aleph rather than barring other letters and combining them together? To answer that, we need to understand the meaning of life according to Judaism in 90 seconds or less. Aren't you good? Maybe you came for lunch today, you're going to learn the meaning of life according to Judaism in 90 seconds or less. And the meaning of life according to Judaism in 90 seconds or less is, if you were on the 1960s TV game show called Let's Make a Deal, and I choose that game show because it has Jewish content. Because Monty Hall, who was the MC, was a Canadian Jew. It's about as Jewish as the show got. But anyway, if you're in Let's Make a Deal, I'll tell you what's behind one of three curtains you can pick. Behind curtain number one, there's infinite knowledge. If you take curtain number one, you'll know everything there is to know in the universe. And behind curtain number two is infinite pleasure. If you take curtain number two, you'll live in infinite ecstasy forever. And behind curtain number three is God sitting on his throne. There's an empty chair nearby. If you take curtain number three, you get to hang out with God forever. So now, which curtain do you take? Judaism says there's nothing wrong with curtain number one. We're a knowledge-based religion. The top mitzvah is to learn Torah, try to understand how the world works. Sign me up. Curtain number one is an excellent choice. Curtain number two, infinite pleasure. Absolutely. Judaism says take curtain number two. We're here to get pleasure. That's what this world's about. It's a fantastic choice as well. However, you really have to take curtain number three. Not that there's anything wrong with the other possibilities, but when you take a connection back to God, which is what curtain number three offers, so you're getting the source. You're relating back. You're connecting back to the source of the knowledge of curtain one, and the source of the pleasure curtain two, and the source of the curtains, and the source of Monty Hall, and the source of game shows. Why go for a slice of pie when you get the pie factory? So the meaning of life according to Judaism, and as it's said in a more sophisticated version other than TV game shows, it's said actually in the Talmud, in the section of Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers. It says like this, the exact same idea. It says, listen, you are a soul. You are not a body. The essential you has to be the neshama, the soul. Why? Because the cells of your body you learned in eighth grade are constantly changing. You don't have the same cells you had a few years ago. Those cells are gone. Why do you look similar when you look in the mirror? Because your cells replicate themselves similarly, but you don't have the same cells. So the cells you have now are coming from the proteins and amino acids of the food you eat, right? So you have to be, when you think of who am I, you have to be something that transcends those souls. And the answer is yes, you are. It's called, those cells. You're a soul. That's why a person could, God forbid, lose an arm and not lose a sense of self. Because you weren't those cells. So Judaism says the real you is the soul. The body's on loan is good for 80, 90, 100 years, you don't know how long. But that's basically the combination you call you is put in this long corridor, this long hallway leading up to the world to come. And that's called your lifetime. And your job during that lifetime is make decisions which connect you back to God. That leads to two very easy, very important definitions according to Judaism. The definition of good. You notice I'm talking really fast? I'm not hyper. And I haven't really caffeinated, but I just am trying to cover a lot of material. You'll stop me, though, if I lose you, right? Because I'm going to move quickly because there's a lot of material. Okay, good. Okay, fine. You were just sort of staring at me funny, so I just want to make sure that moves. Okay, fine. Two very important, very easy definitions according to Judaism. Good is that which connects me to God. Evil is that which distances me. Right? Good is that which connects me. Evil is that which distances me. Notice that the definitions of good and evil according to Judaism have nothing to do with what you like. In other words, good is that which connects me to God, even if I don't like it. And evil is that which distances me from God, even if I do like it. Right? So let's do a test. If you were a French farmer in 1940, and you were hiding Jews in your basement, and a Nazi bangs on the door and says, "Are you hiding any Jews in your basement?" You say, "You Nazi, what you're doing is evil. You should leave the German army. It's wrong, and therefore, but I too am trying to work on my own ethics and morality. I'm trying not to lie because it's not good for my soul. And therefore, I have to tell you that I am hiding Jews in my basement, but you shouldn't take them." Now, according to the Torah's definition, was that good or was that evil?
Unbalanced evil.
Right. Because practicing not lying for those 60 seconds is going to cause a dozen people to get shot. Causing a dozen people to get shot is a distancer from God. Clear? So the meaning of life really is, I'm here to connect back to God. Now, if that's true, then if it were theoretically possible for me to go back in time, pre-day one of creation, before there was a universe, before there was time, matter, space, and energy, let's say I could go back pre-day one of creation, what would I find? According to Judaism, you'd find the infinite oneness, infinite perfection of God, nothing else, because he hasn't done anything else yet, right? So if the meaning of life, according to Judaism, is I'm here to connect back to the infinite oneness, infinite perfection of God, then it doesn't get any easier to fulfill the meaning of life according to Judaism other than pre-day one, because there's nothing else to do. Right? What are you going to do today? Well, today hasn't been invented yet. So, if on day one the Almighty creates a universe, and that universe starts to expand, it must mean that on day one it was harder to fulfill the meaning of life according to Judaism and connect back to God than it was pre-day one, because now there's something to distract me. And if you follow the logic, as the universe expands and gains order, structure, and complexity, it must have been harder to connect back to God on day two than it was day one. Whatever these days mean according to the Torah, what you see is clearly, with each succeeding day of creation, the mask of nature, with its physics, chemistry, and biology, is gaining, increasing order, structure, and complexity, and the mask is getting thicker and thicker. So day four must have been harder to connect back to God than day three, and day five must have been harder to connect back than day four. And what you get with, what you arrive at ultimately, is the Torah describing 6 days of creation, whatever that means, putting human beings on the other side of day six and saying, the meaning of life is connection back to me, God says, and you and I can go through our entire lifetime saying connection back to who? I don't know if God exists. I don't know if I have a soul. I don't know if Judaism's true. But I do know I have to go to work, and I do not have to pay my bills. There's plenty I know. But God's spirituality, who knows? That's how thick the mask of nature got over the first 6 days. Now, that means that if the purpose of creation is connection back to God, the act of creation is making it more and more difficult. Which means that the purpose of the creation and the act of creation were opposites. Now, if you and I could figure out that the purpose of creation and the act of creation were opposites in under 2 minutes, why couldn't God? And the answer, obviously, is he could. So what did he do it for? And the answer to that question, this fundamental question of why they go in opposite directions, goes back to when I was in the fifth grade. Now, what people understood before I was in the fifth grade, I don't know. But I figured this out in the fifth grade. Because in the fifth grade, what we used to do, obviously, you're a more mature audience, so you would never do this. You should never do this, by the way. What we used to do is we used to take paper clips and bend them. And we used to hook them to rubber bands and take aim at the head of the kid sitting next to us. Now, and these things used to sting terribly. Nowadays in the school system, I understand they're using pistols. But in my day, we used to take rubber bands and paper clips. Now, the only time you could shoot this kid in the head with a paper clip or put it down was when the teacher was out of the room. Because you never touched a rubber band and paper clip when the teacher was standing in front of your desk. You didn't want to get in trouble. And that's exactly what the Almighty's doing. Because the reason why he has to build a mask just thick enough to put you and I on the other side and tell us the meaning of life's connection back to him, but now it's just thick enough so that maybe he exists, maybe he doesn't. Maybe he's in the room right now, maybe he's not. Maybe science can explain everything. Maybe everything's a random accident. Maybe there is no God. At that point where the mask is just thick enough, so maybe God's in the room right now, maybe he's not, that's where your and my free will begin. And without hiding himself, we'd have no free will. We all know that if the Almighty took the mask of nature and took the rules of physics, chemistry, biology and ripped them apart, even for 30 seconds, just tore nature apart for 30 seconds and appeared in front of you and said, guess what? I really do exist. What are you going to do, be secular? Answer is, you just took religion and forced it down your throat. And you can't have a relationship with anybody at gunpoint, right? I always tell my students at Neve, I teach women from non-religious backgrounds at a college in Jerusalem. I always tell my students, If I take your fiance the day before he marries you, and by using hypnosis and chemicals, I brainwash him into absolutely loving and adoring you, so that by the time he marries you, he just follows you around the house all day like a lovesick puppy, right? He won't go to work in the morning because he can't stand the thought of being away from you for eight hours. As if the first few hours of marriage would be nice, but eventually you throw him off a building. Why? Because that's not a husband, that's a robot. What makes a relationship is his decision to stay, but the capability of leaving. The Almighty is so overwhelmingly perfect and pleasurable, you couldn't disconnect, and therefore he has to go into hiding. Now, that is the purpose of the first 6 days of creation, and that is the meaning of the sixth letter of the alphabet, the letter Vav. The letter Vav in Torah mysticism, that Vav right there, position number six, is physical completion. Because whenever you see sixes in Torah, whenever you see six of anything, you always have to think physical completion. In other words, the mask of nature that hides God went to six before it stopped, 6 days. Now, we all know God's outside of time. So he's not affected by time, he generates time. So therefore, time's irrelevant. So he could have created all of creation, including human beings, in the first instance of the first day. He doesn't need six of anything. But he's trying to teach you that each one of these days corresponds to a concept. And when you get to six of these concepts, you now have the concept of physical completion. That's why any three-dimensional object in the universe is a part of the mask of nature which hides God, like this cheap, ugly polyurethane eraser. Any three-dimensional object always has six expressions. It's got an up and a down and an east, west, north, and south. That gives this eraser, according to Judaism, two functions. One is to erase the board, and the other is to be a part of the mask of nature which hides God, right? That is the idea of sixes in the Torah. And whenever you see it, you have to think, Vav is the letter that represents the mask of nature which hides God. Okay? That is the letter Vav. Any questions on that so far?
I've heard that defined as faith.
What's faith?
Vav.
Vav is faith? Okay, after class you'll explain it to me. fine. Now, Vav literally has a definition. If you go into a hardware... Oh, I've got Israelis here. If you go into a hardware store in Israel and you buy a Vav, what do you walk out with? A hook, right? Coats are held up with Vavs, right, in Hebrew? As a matter of fact, if you look in the Torah's description of the Mishkan, the tabernacle, the sanctuary we took around with us in the desert over 40 years, there were lots of curtains. They were all held up with Vavs. You actually see the word Vav in the text. It's spelled Vav, Vav, right? Vavs. So a Vav literally is a hook. And that's why in Hebrew grammar, when the Almighty puts a Vav, which is a V sound in English, the, in front of a word in Hebrew, it becomes the conjunction and, A-N-D, because it hooks things together. Ani v'ata. Ani v'akise. Me and the chair. So the Vav hooks things together physically. That's why it's the conjunction and. Okay, in Hebrew grammar? Yeah, you with me? Okay, everybody? Yeah, okay, fine. So, on a mystical level, for those of you who've studied a little Torah, if you've ever had a chance to open it up and look at the actual Hebrew text, you'll see that the Almighty uses it as more than a conjunction and. He uses it actually to hook time. Because a vav in front of a verb root will take the verb from future tense to past tense and vice versa. So the Almighty uses it to hook time, but we just use it to hook objects together when we speak. Okay, fine. Now, if I were the Almighty's graphic artist, and he asked me to design a letter representing physical completion, I never would have chosen the shape of a vav, because a vav, in essence, is just a straight line, and it doesn't look very physically complete. Ink is physical. So if I were to design a letter representing the mask of nature which hides God, physical completion, I would use lots of ink, movement, texture, a certain je ne sais quoi, right? And that would be my letter of physicality. It would be a work of art. And I was not consulted, and therefore that is not the letter of physical completion, but you got the idea, right? You want physicality when you design a letter of physicality. The Almighty chose the line for whatever reason. It's not for today's class. But if he came to me and he said, listen, I want you to design a letter representing the spiritual realm. I want a letter representing heaven, spirituality, non-physicality. I'd say, well, that's easy, because ink is physical. If you want a letter representing the spiritual realm, leave a blank spot. Don't use any ink. That would be your letter representing the spiritual realm. To which he'd probably reply, nice try, but you can't read a Torah scroll where the letters are blank spots because you wouldn't know where words start and stop, so you have to use ink. So if he says to me, I have to use ink, I say, fine. I make a dot. That would be my letter of spirituality. Least amount of physical ink possible, that would represent the spiritual realm as far as I'm concerned, and that's exactly what the Almighty did. Because the letter of the Hebrew alphabet that represents spirituality is the least amount of ink of any letter, and it's the only letter in Hebrew actually that floats up in the air. All the other letters of the Hebrew alphabet sit on a line except for Yud. Yud floats up in the air because it represents the spiritual realm. It represents heaven. In a human being, it'll represent your soul as opposed to your body. Excuse me. The truth is, in a human being, not only can it represent your soul, but think about this carefully. It can represent your thoughts. Because your thoughts seem to transcend the electrical, chemical synapses, right, in your brain. So Yud is also the letter of thought, as well as spirituality, because they're very similar. Okay? So that's why, just for fun, if you take a verb root, let's take the verb daber, which means to speak. Okay? That's the word daber. When the Almighty grammatically puts a yud in front of a verb root, what does he do to the verb? He pushes it into the future tense, right? Yuds push verbs into the future. Why? Because the future is not in the physical world, it's only in the realm of thought. And Yud is the letter of thought. So it pushes things into the future. Okay, that's how the Almighty works with these letters. So we have Yud as the letter of spirituality, but you have to ask the question, why did he assign the letter of spirituality a value of 10? Why is 10 so spiritual? I thought 7 was spiritual, 7 is Shabbat. So to understand why spirituality gets a value of 10, we have to, right, there's 10 commandments, 10 plagues, there's lots of 10s, but it doesn't tell me why it's spiritual. We have to go back in time pre-day one of creation again, when all there was the infinite oneness, infinite perfection of God. Now, if you think about it for a second, if God is really infinitely one, there can be nothing else. Because whenever there's something else, it violates his oneness. In other words, theoretically anyway, when the Almighty creates a universe, let's say he wills into existence an atom or an electron or something. So now there's God plus an electron. So how can you say God's infinitely one? There's something else there. So what's plagued philosophers for thousands of years is, how did God create a universe with lots of things in it and still remain infinitely one? And the way he did that, according to Jewish mysticism, is that we use a metaphor to try to explain the process that God used to generate reality without violating his oneness. This metaphor is brought down in Kabbalah. It's brought down in the Zohar, the books of Jewish mysticism. We're allowed to study it, actually. It's very interesting. It's a very simple metaphor. It's only got two steps. We're allowed to study it as long as we know before we study it that it's really not accurate. In other words, you're allowed to use it if you realize it's not accurate. Why? Because if you think about it for a second, our finite brains work within time, which means in a human brain, thought A leads to thought B leads to thought C, which allows you to conclude D. Right? But that's happening within time. So you've got a finite brain working within time, trying to understand something infinite outside of time, and it's just not going to work. But the metaphor is just designed to help us get close. Okay, so here comes a two-step metaphor, very simple, for how God creates a universe without violating his oneness. Step one of this metaphor is going to be negative. Step two is going to be positive. I'm going to teach you the metaphor, and then at the end of it, you're going to tell me where it fails. Okay, you're going to see if you can spot the flaw. Okay, here we go. In step one of the metaphor, God is so overwhelmingly, infinitely one that nothing else could possibly exist. It's just not possible. He's too, T-O-O, one-ish for anything else to exist. Got the idea? Yeah? In other words, if I had to use my own metaphor for that metaphor, I moved to the other end of the room to create a contrast. Did you notice that? I did that. Whatever, anyway. So if my metaphor would be, let's pretend you were a solar physicist and you study the sun and you load your instruments into a spaceship and you sail towards the sun to measure solar flares. So from 10 million miles away, you measure your solar flares. From 10,000 miles away, the sun at its core is 15 million degrees Fahrenheit. So it's so overwhelmingly hot-ish that when you're only 10,000 miles away, the atoms, molecules, and electrons of your body and of your instruments and of your spaceship will fuse into hydrogen and you will become sun. Do you understand? It's too hot-ish for you to be you. Got it? So let's go back to the Kabbalistic metaphor. God's so infinitely one, nothing else is going to exist. So in step one of the metaphor, he, metaphorically speaking, pulls himself back and creates a space. That space is called a space, where God is out of the way enough to allow for the possibility for something else to exist. It's got a long name, right? A space where God is out of the way enough to allow for the possibility for something to exist. But notice that nothing else does exist. It's just now possible. That was step one. Why is it called negative? Because God hasn't done anything yet. He's just removed. Okay? In step two of the metaphor, he's going to will or zap or whatever into that space, what we call our universe. That's where it's going to unfold. Okay, that's step two. That's called positive because now he's doing something. You need both steps to get reality according to the metaphor. Now, without one step or the other, nothing happens. That's a metaphor. I told you it wasn't accurate. Did you spot where it failed? Did anyone catch where it failed? Where was the flaw in the metaphor? Nobody spotted it? Really? Want me to do it again?
Yeah.
In step one, God, he's so one-ish, nothing else is going to exist. So step one, he pulls himself back, creates a space, and that space is a long name, a space where God is out of the way enough to allow for the possibility for something else to exist. That's step one. And step two, he wills, you know, time, matter, space, energy, whatever we call reality, our universe to unfold within that space. That's step two. Where's the flaw in the metaphor? The problem is the likeliness of the separation? What do you mean?
That there is an assumed separation between God and what God is creating.
That might be a flaw in my description, but not. I don't know if it's a flaw in the metaphor. Yeah.
Does step two negate step one?
Maybe similar to those ideas, but when he wills it into existence, isn't he, in a sense, putting himself back into the space?
Mm-mm. No. The axiom of Judaism we're violating here is that if God is infinite, he's infinite in everywhere, and therefore he doesn't get out of the way. What do you mean a space where he's out of the way? Where'd he go? There's nowhere to pull back to. In other words, God is still infinitely everywhere, so he's still in the space. Those just think it's a space where God's out of the way. That's ridiculous. So the metaphor really failed in its first sentence. So how come we're allowed to use it? Answer is, because it's just trying to push our brains closer to the idea. So fortunately, along came a more recent commentary on Jewish mysticism. His name was Rabbi Chaim from the town of Belazhin. He was a top student in the Vilna Gaon, if you've ever studied a little Torah. He lived about 200 years ago. He wrote a very beautiful work taking these complex Kabbalistic ideas that actually, if you think about them too hard, make your brain hurt, like God getting out of the way when you know he doesn't get out of the way. And he says, listen, I'm going to say the exact same thing as that metaphor. But I'm going to say it in a way that's easier on your brain. You can use the original version, which is thousands of years old. You can use my version. It doesn't matter. It's the same thing. He says, instead of saying God pulled himself back to create a space where he was out of the way enough to allow for something else to exist, he said, why don't you just say God hid himself? He just hid himself enough to allow for the possibility for something else to exist. That way, your brain doesn't have to try to reconcile the fact that he went somewhere, because he didn't. So that version, that more recent version, is the one I use when I try to imagine the metaphor, okay? God going into hiding. Now, once you understand the two-step metaphor, you now understand where Torah and science diverge. Because what does science say? Science says 15 billion years ago there was a Big Bang, right? Time, matter, space, and energy, physics, chemistry, biology start unfolding, gaining order, structure, complexity, and evolve to what you see out of the window today. It takes about 15 billion years. Judaism says it's not true, right? What about where the Big Bang came from? Science says, well, that's probably in the realm of religion. It could have been God. We don't know. We can't measure before things become measurable. So pre-Big Bang, you know, it's hard for them to say. But we say, one second, this 15 billion year evolving thing, forget it. Why? Because think about it for a second. If you don't have both steps in the metaphor, you don't get reality. So according to us, any instant where the Almighty doesn't hide himself enough to allow for the possibility for something else to exist, or any instant where he doesn't become the source of that existence, then nothing exists, right? You need both steps. So for example, you see the atoms, molecules, and electrons of this wood and whatever, plastic chair? So if I could go to Southern California and buy spiritual glasses, which allow me to see beyond the physical world, allow me to see spirituality, and I put them on, and I take a look at this chair, and I say, guess what? You thought the atoms, molecules, and electrons in this chair have an independent existence, but if you put on these spiritual glasses and look again, you'll see that every atom, molecule, and electron is constantly being beamed into existence
by some infinitely one, infinitely perfect source up there. You just can't see the beam without the glasses. So those beams would be the constant willing of into existence of the atoms, molecules, and electrons of the chair. That's what Judaism says. It can't be 15 billion years ago. It has to be every single instant, according to us. Right? That's why, by the way, if you ever open up an Orthodox Jewish prayer book and read the prayers, even in English, you watch the prayers carefully. When we thank God who created the universe, we never thank him in the past tense. We always thank God who creates the universe. Isn't that interesting? Because for us, it has to be present tense, right? So it's like going to a theater, a movie theater, and you see an actor walk across the screen. And in reality, you know, there's no one walking across the screen. It's just lights on the screen, right? So in the back of the room, there's a projector. And in reality, there's no one walking in the projector either. There's a film. And in the film, there's hundreds and hundreds of single images, single frames. And in each frame of the film, the actor's leg is in a slightly different position. And the projector fires them at a screen so fast. As a matter of fact, the rate is 24 frames a second. So your retina can't refresh its image at a rate of 24 frames a second. So your eye is fooled into seeing a fluid motion, when in reality, if our eyes were faster, we'd see hundreds of single images, right? So according to Judaism, that's how the world works. In other words, according to the Torah, the reason why you and I see a constant image of each other is because we're being recreated so many times per instant, we look like we're constantly here. And that's true for you and me, it's true for the chair, it's true for everything. That's how the universe works according to Judaism.
Does that mean we're not actually
here? No, we are actually here. It's just that it's a constant source of God's will, as opposed to being created a long time ago and living on your own, which is more of a scientific explanation. So the length of time to 15 billion years was never the issue. It's just whether it started then or whether it began, and it's constant from that point on. Okay? So what I want to do, what I want to do is graph it for you, because I think it's very beautiful to see visually. Let's take the infinite oneness, infinite perfection of God, and put God, so to speak, at the top of the system, right? Here's the infinite oneness, infinite perfection of God. We're going to call God up, let's say. And then the spiritual realm, heaven, the spiritual realm he creates, according to Judaism, actually has lots of levels in it, right? It has more than four, each one subdivided, which is subdivided, which is subdivided ad infinitum. Now, let's say from here down, this lowest level of the spiritual realm, from here down would be our universe with its billions of galaxies. Each galaxy has billions of stars. And we'll put a human being down here. We'll put a human being down here on the planet Earth. And no, it is not to scale. Okay? It's just whatever. Anyway, so let's pretend up here the Almighty's will looks like red light. I'm going to talk in terms of watts of light, okay? So up here, let's say there's a billion, trillion, gazillion watts of infinite oneness, infinite perfection. And it's so infinitely one and infinitely perfect up there, nothing else could possibly exist. It's too, T-O-O, one-ish for anything else to exist. Now, when the Almighty takes his will and sends it down through the spiritual realms that he creates, because he creates these realms, so what the Kabbalists say is these levels of the spiritual realm, he wills them to act like filters. They're like big, you know, sunglasses, so to speak. So when he sends his will down, it goes from 100 billion trillion gazillion watts of infinite oneness and perfection, but as it passes down through the spiritual realm, it's now down to 100 billion watts of infinite oneness and perfection, down to 10 billion watts, down to 1 billion watts, down to 100 million watts of infinite oneness and perfection, 10 million watts, 1 million watts, 100,000 watts, 10,000 watts of infinite oneness and perfection, 1,000 watts. By the time God's will crosses the lowest level of the spiritual realm, he's filtered it down to, let's make up a number, let's say 0.0001 watts of infinite oneness, infinite perfection. And it looks like this chair. And that's why, even though the atoms, molecules, and electrons of this chair are coming every instant from a godly source, doesn't glow and it doesn't sparkle. Right? Doesn't look godly. Because according to us, I don't know where this chart comes from, but according to us, it would have, you know, science would have a very good explanation where the atoms, molecules, electrons of this chair comes from, and they don't need God. You know, the plastic comes from distilled petrochemicals, which comes from degraded biomass, which comes from living organisms and plants, which died under tremendous pressure and temperature over millions of years, which come from simple organisms, which come from precursor molecules, which come from random accident, and we don't need God. So that's where they say the plastic comes from. But we say this chair has two functions. One is to sit on, and the other is to be a part of the mask of nature, which hides God. And it does both functions very well. So once you have God's oneness filtered down so it doesn't look infinitely one anymore, you can get the illusion of diversity. And chairs don't look like pencils, and pencils don't look like light bulbs, and light bulbs don't look like trees, trees don't look like dogs, dogs don't look like rocks, and rocks don't look like water. And all of a sudden you get this huge spectrum of diversity, which really effectively creates a mask of nature which hides God. Because we all know that if rocks and pencils and trees and water and dogs and plants and light bulbs all look the same, so it would push you towards understanding that there's an infinitely one source giving rise to it. And then, of course, nature would not effectively hide God anymore. So it creates the illusion of diversity. So if we go back to the first 2 minutes of the class and we say, well, the meaning of life according to Judaism is I'm here to connect back to God, right? So back using the alphabet, that would be the meaning of life is I'm here to connect back to the Aleph. I'm here to connect back to God's oneness. What does God say? He says, I'm sorry, I can't let you do that. I can't let you connect directly back to me. I'm so overwhelmingly perfect and overwhelmingly pleasurable. You lose your free will. You'd be a robot. And therefore, you don't get a connection directly back to God's oneness. He's too hidden. What you do is you see that the Almighty hides himself behind a spectrum of diversity. He hides himself behind a mask of nature where nothing seems the same. So as you move down the spectrum of diversity, you're looking for oneness. And where's the next place you can find oneness? Hello?
The Yud.
Not the Yud. What aspect?
The Aleph.
When you have 10. What's 10? One of something, no remainder. In other words, 10 always represents a unity behind diversity. Actually, the truth is, we all learned that in second grade. Remember, I don't know if you remember your second grade math book, but in your second grade math book, 1 through 9 were all natural numbers, so your math book used sticks or pencils. Remember this little pictures of sticks or pencils? But 10's not a natural number. 10's a cognitive number. 10's a concept. 10's a set. Right? So what your math book would do would be bundle the sticks with the pencils, because it's a concept. 10 means I've got one set with nothing left over, which represents the idea that there's oneness behind the diversity. So my access to spirituality is not direct. I'll lose my free will. My access to spirituality is to take all the diversity and say it doesn't fool me. It must be coming from one source. That's why that answers the question we had 10 minutes ago. Yud is the letter of spirituality. Why did the Almighty assign it a value of 10? The answer is because the way he created the world, 10 represents a unity behind diversity. And that's why. How many mitzvahs are there? 613. Why do they distill down to 10 commandments? Because that's the unity behind the diversity. Or if you look at the first 6 days of creation, where the Almighty hid himself behind a mask of nature over those first 6 days, if you count up the statements of creation over those first 6 days, let there be this, let there be this, let there be this, there are 10 statements of creation over the first 6 days. The Almighty, so to speak, layered the mask with 10 layers that hit him over those first 6 days. That's why there are 10 statements of creation. Which explains why later in history, when Moses goes in front of Pharaoh and says, you know, if you don't let the Jewish people go, the same God who built up those 10 layers to hide himself, he's going to start peeling them apart. He's going to go from the outermost layer back in. Eventually you'll be left with nothing and you're going to lose. And Pharaoh says, I don't believe there's a God that can do that. And Moses says, then you're going to lose. And that's exactly what happens. And that's why the commentaries point out that the mask thickened in layers like an onion. But in Egypt, the 10 plagues peeled them back in reverse order. So you have to line up the plagues in Egypt against the statements of creation in reverse order. We'll do the simplest one, because it would be a class in and of itself to go through all 10. The simplest one is the second statement of creation is let there be light, which corresponds to the ninth plague, which is the plague of darkness, right? So the idea of building up the mask in layers and then peeling it back is what the tens relate to. All tens in Judaism will line up like that. 10 commandments, 10 plagues, the same as creation, they all line up. Because we're dealing with the layering of the mask. Now, the truth is that the Almighty created us to be metaphors for that. In other words, if you study Torah deeply, you'd understand why grass is green and why sky is blue and why water is wet. The Torah says that everything in the world really is a metaphor for a spiritual idea. For example, human beings are like that. The Almighty says that he created human beings to represent concepts. The Talmud says that human beings are the only true vertical animal.
which means that you have to prioritize your drives vertically. Meaning that the lowest part of you, the lowest level drive in a human being metaphorically would be food, sexuality, entertainment, right? That's the physical drives, that's the lowest part of the person. That's why if you marry somebody because they're good looking and they have money, you're not gonna make it 5 years, right? Higher than that vertically is the heart, that's emotion. So if yes, there's a physical attraction, and yes, I love this person, so emotions are a higher level than physical drives, you have a fighting chance of trying to make a marriage work 5 years. The problem with emotions, we all know, is that sometimes you wake up in the morning, you don't feel anything, right? Emotions are also fickle. So it can't be the highest level. And the truth is, the way we're built vertically, it's not. The highest level is intellect. And therefore, when you make decisions, like especially in relationships, obviously, so yes, there has to be a physical attraction. And yes, there's supposed to be emotional connection. The highest levels say, I can help this person fulfill their potential. I can be the partner they need. I can help them complete themselves, right? If I have that understanding, and that's the highest level priority, because it's the top of my body, I get a chance of making a marriage work 60 years. That's a much more powerful hierarchy than just working on lower levels. Unfortunately, most people don't take their decision making up that high, but that's the way we build vertically. So go back to creation. The Almighty goes from oneness of intention and hides himself behind a mask, a spectrum of nature with 10 different statements. So we're metaphors. Like, in other words, if I have oneness of thought in my head right now, you don't know what I'm thinking because you can't read my mind. But in Judaism, your arms always represent your actions. That's why it says that God took us out of Egypt with an outstretched arm, and we don't look for freckles because God doesn't have an arm. So what does it mean to take us out with an outstretched arm? It means he's taking an idea and he's bringing it out into action. So, so too, if I have an idea of oneness of thought in my head, you can't read my mind, but if you look at my actions, you can work backwards and figure out what I was thinking. For example, if I stopped the class and I ran over and I grabbed this glass of water and I start chugging like crazy, even though I don't tell you what I'm thinking, you look at my actions, you work backwards, you say, I know exactly what he was thinking. He was thinking he was so thirsty he couldn't finish the class, and you'd be exactly right. So when we go from oneness of thought, which is just like how the Almighty created the world, the Almighty created our action spectrum to end in a spectrum of 10. We are built base 10 because we mimic those first 6 days of creation where the Almighty's oneness came down and divided into a spectrum of 10. That's why we have 10 digits at the end of our arms, which represent actions. Okay? Everyone follow that? Now the problem is going to be that even though God's oneness comes down and divides into a spectrum of 10, he wired our finite senses, smell, touch, taste, hearing, sight, into the bottom 7 of those 10 layers. In other words, we only perceive nature operating in the cycle of the bottom 7. The upper three that are coming down to this world, thank you. The upper three coming down to this world, that metaphor about being so thirsty I couldn't finish was only a metaphor, so but I appreciate the water anyway. Our senses are wired into the bottom 7 of those 10 layers. The upper three are too spiritual, and therefore we perceive nature cycling in sevens even though the flow is really 10. Did you follow that? You didn't follow that, did you? Am I moving too fast? I am, aren't I? I'm just trying to finish on time. I'm feeling guilty. Yeah. Are you guys with me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
You're just not leaving Chicago for a couple weeks.
No, I feel terrible, but I really want to finish on time because I'm scared you guys are going to make important conferences and stuff like that, meetings, and whatever.
The top three are spiritual and the bottom.
The top three you can't perceive, but they're here. It's like they would be in thought, but you can't, right? So nature cycles in the bottom sevens, according to us. So that's why you take white light and you divide it through a prism, you'll see 7 colors, right? Or in our Western system, our tonal system, it's 7 notes that repeat, 7 notes that repeat. That's how the octave works. Or, for example, there's a logic to why there's a 30-day month, because the moon goes from full to full every 29.8 days. And there's a logic to a 365-day year, because the Earth goes around the sun every 365 days. There's no logic to a 7-day week. Interesting? 7 doesn't go into 30. 7 doesn't go into 365. So why do all civilizations have a 7-day week? The answer is because from the beginning of history, we've been tracking nature cycling in sevens. We've all picked it up. That's how nature cycles, according to us, right? So we're not perceiving the entire flow. We're just perceiving the natural world cycling in the bottom 7 of those layers. Now, we have enough information at this point to go back and answer the question we started with. I don't want to say how long ago, but we can actually go analyze the shape of the Aleph now. But before we do that, with your permission, I want to do a 2-minute tangent to show you that everything we've covered at this lunch session is not all up in the air, theoretical, I don't know, mystical, you know, Kabbalistic, whatever, that's not terribly applicable. I want to try to show you that if you followed everything we covered so far today, certain things in Judaism that make no sense will start making sense. Okay? Just so we can put a practical side to the theory. For example, there's a verse in the Torah that when you were a child and you heard about, made perfect sense. The verse we actually say at Kiddush, when we recite Kiddush on Shabbat lunch, you know, Shabbat day, at the meal, the verse says, in 6 days God created the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he rested. Now, when you were in the third grade and you were going to Sunday school, hating every minute of it, swearing you'd never send your kids there, right? So the teacher said, you know, the Torah says that in 6 days God created the heavens and the earth, and 7 days he rested, therefore there's a mitzvah, it's a command for us to rest as well. So that was nice, you know, you watch TV, you don't go to work, you hang out on the couch, you whatever, you go swing, movies, whatever, everybody's doing their own thing. But the truth is that only worked on the third grade level. You come back as an adult and you look at that verse and you say, whoa, 1 second, that verse makes no sense whatsoever. I work hard all week, I'm human, I need to rest, but God? God's outside of time. He's not affected by anything. God's no different before, during, or after creation. There's no 6 days of creation that could affect God. God doesn't rest from anything. Nothing affects it. He doesn't rest, we rest. That's problem number one. And problem number two is, if everything we said is true, and the Almighty is the constant source of reality, every single instant, if he were to rest, the universe would disappear. Imagine what it would be like to light Shabbat candles Friday afternoon as the sun went down, only to disappear till Saturday night, you and the universe. You'd reappear Saturday night and go to therapy to try to prepare yourself for the next disappearance a week later, every week. It would be traumatic. If God rests, there's no reality. So number one, he doesn't rest. That's too anthropomorphic. It assigns human characteristics. And number two is, if he rests, we're out of here. There's nothing. So we have to come back to the verse as adults and say, 1 second, if it's in the Torah, it must be true. But I've got to get rid of my third grade understanding of the verse because that's ridiculous. And that's a problem. The verse is true. The understanding's wrong. Let's see if we can work it through based on what we've covered together. Let's think about it. In 6 days, God created the heavens and the earth. On the seventh day, he rested. So now, what is he resting from? You tell me. What is he resting from on the seventh day? He's resting from creating what? Creating the universe, which is the mask of nature, correct? He's resting from creating the mask of nature. What was the function of the mask of nature? Why did he do it?
To hide
himself, right? To give you free will. Therefore, he's resting from hiding. You follow? Because what he has to do is he has to build a mask of nature just thick enough so that maybe exists, maybe doesn't, to give you the free will to theoretically, God forbid, walk away. I don't believe in God. I'm not interested. But what he says is, I'm going to create a window of opportunity for the last 24 hours of the week, Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. And he says, what I'm going to do is I'm going to rest from thickening that mask. He doesn't get rid of the mask because the universe doesn't disappear on Shabbat. But he does rest from thickening it, which means that the whole purpose of creation is I'm here to connect my soul back to God. It must be easier to access God because he's behind the thinner mask on Shabbat than it is on a Tuesday. And therefore, if on Shabbat I'm watching TV, going to the movies, I'm going to work, I'm, you know, doing all these things to act like it's a Wednesday, so what am I in effect doing? I'm thickening the mask. The Almighty's up there thinning the mask to make for an easier connection, and I'm down here thickening it. He's going, what are you doing? You're ruining the whole effect. So if he's up there thinning it, and for my part, I refrain from whatever creative mask thickening types of work there is, and I allow the mask to thin a little bit, he's thinning it, I'm thinning it, and the net mask my neshama has to cross to connect back to him is as thin as it gets all week. And now I'm doing Shabbat correctly. And that's why, hang on 1 second, let me just finish the thought. That's why, you know, I teach at college campuses all across the United States 3 times a year. I can't tell you how many places I go where people are absolutely clueless what it means to work on Shabbat. Nobody gets this right. I'll give you an example of how people get confused. If on Shabbat, I take my sofa from my basement, which weighs 200 pounds, and I put it on my back just to see what it looks like in my attic, and I schlep it up 3 flights of stairs, and I put it in the attic of my house, and I say, oh, what a big mistake. Clashes with the carpets, clashes with the walls, doesn't really fit. Put it back on my back, schlep it down 3 flights of stairs, back to my basement, all on Shabbat. After Shabbat, I go to the hospital in traction for 6 weeks with a chiropractor working on my back every day.
And I did a lot of work, but I never violated the Sabbath. Why? Because the couch was already there. I just moved it around. Well, on the other hand, Yevon Shabbat, I take this finger, and with 1/1000th of a calorie, and no effort whatsoever, I flick on that light switch. I just violated Shabbat, because that light wasn't there before. And I just thickened the mass. And therefore, work never had to do with effort. It always has to do with, am I thickening the mass and therefore blocking my ability to connect back to God for those 24 hours? Or am I allowing the mass to thin by refraining from the categories of creative work that the Almighty used to hide himself? That's what the Torah defines. That's what keeping Shabbat is. That's a practical side to everything we've worked on for the last 45 minutes. So you can see it's not just theory. It actually has a real applicable side to it, okay? That was our tangent. Now, I was pushing off questions, yeah.
Is it apt to say that Shabbat thins the mass, or he just stops, right?
He thins. Because it doesn't say, 6 days God created the heavens and the earth, and then there was the Sabbath. It implies there's a resting, which means he's doing something, even though it sounds like he's not. So it's a thinning of the mass.
It doesn't mean he stopped. It means he rested.
It means he's creating an accessibility that wasn't there Sunday through Friday.
Exposing himself.
It's no, because that would take away your free will. He's less hidden, so there's a greater accessibility.
So is the analogy, would it be sort of synonymous to say he kind of pared back creation a little bit on the seventh day?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, I guess I'm stuck on resting. To me means, in essence, stopping. You're describing it as doing something, which sounds like he's purposely reversing a little bit.
Because the natural state should be infinite oneness of God, nothing else. And therefore, he's forcing a mass into existence that's active. And when he rests from that, it's less active.
So the mask is sort of a bombardment. It's not a...
It's a constant reality that's being interposed between you and God.
It's instantaneous.
By the way,
all of our distractions.
Just for fun, I can't resist doing this. It's not a part of the class, but just because you asked me on it, just for fun, the mask is not only in time.
Yeah, mask is what?
The mask is not only in time. Oh. Why do all three of the world's major religions want Jerusalem? Because the mask thins in geography. It's thinner in the land of Israel, and it's the thinnest in Jerusalem, and it gets even thinner at the Temple Mount. And therefore, people are more inclined to go pray at the wall than they are in the back of my garage in Brooklyn, even though the back of my garage has cinder blocks with cracks in it that they could stick notes in. Save themselves $1,400 out, round trip airfare. And you say, you know, Judaism says God's equally everywhere, isn't he? He's equally in my garage as he is in the wall, isn't that true? Answer is absolutely, he's everywhere. But the mask is thicker in Brooklyn than it is in Jerusalem. Therefore, your neshama feels it can connect back easier geographically there than it can in New York. Got the idea? So the mask thins different ways in different places, right?
So it's the same idea of getting buried among the fallen?
I don't know if it's burial. That's a different idea Kabbalistically. But in terms of human beings' ability to access spirituality, it's accessible within time for 24 hours each week, and it's accessible geographically, depending on where you're located on the planet, where the mass fits, okay?
24/7 in Temple Mount area?
Yeah. Yeah.
So now, you're saying that when the mask is, when he's hiding himself, and or she, and the mask...
No gender.
Okay.
God has no gender.
He, so.
Yeah, but if you want an answer to that, you've got to stay another 10 minutes. God has no gender because God's infinitely one and gender's a division.
So let's move on beyond that. Okay, so now when the mask is full, you have your free will.
Correct.
Okay, so now you're in Jerusalem and it's Shabbat and the mask is narrow.
Thinner.
The narrowest, the thinnest that it can possibly be.
That's right.
So then what happens to your free will?
So if you fight it, you can maintain it. But that's why people who are not religious will go to the Kotel and feel something and not know what it is. They just won't know what it is. They say, wow, that was really weird. Or I really felt something, I don't know what it is. And then they'll go into their busy lives again. But if you're sensitive to it, you'll feel it.
So how did any of the
So are you saying that it's not possible to happen in Chicago?
Absolutely possible. No, God forbid. But you got to work harder. More mass to cross.
Don't you
harder.
Think that's individual? As an individual person? You know, what your
that
case
was
and what
so
your...
good. That was so good. Good for you. That's right. Because, and this is a different letter of the alphabet, so I'm really skipping around here. But the truth is, when the Almighty generates a mass to hide him, interestingly enough, he allows ultimately the dial which controls mass thickness to be given over to your free will. And therefore, when you say, God, the mass doesn't fool me, I know you're up there, you're actually dialing it thinner. And when you say, no, science can explain everything, it's all random acts, and I don't believe in God, you're actually dialing it thicker. And the answer is, you're absolutely right. You do ultimately have an impact on how thick the mass is. But
isn't it also true that every letter, what letter comes before and what letter comes after, is all about what one may be able to do or not do, because they're teaching and coming together. There's a reason that each letter is placed where it is because of the way.
Yeah, but I'm not sure what that has to do with the previous day. That is true.
Okay.
We're going to have more questions and answers after.
Yeah, I have to finish. I only actually have about 2 minutes to go, so I'm just going to push off any other questions till the end, because I've basically done my time limit here, and that's what I've been speaking 200 miles an hour to avoid. So let's go back and analyze the original question we started with. If Aleph represents God's oneness, why does it have such a complicated X-like pattern? But now we can answer it, because we understand the letters that are used. Yod is the letter of?
Spirituality.
So the upper yod would represent what?
Heaven.
Right, heaven, God sitting on his throne. Let's make a deal metaphor. That was current number 3, remember? So now, there's also a lower level yod, which applies to the yod down here. What would the yod down here be?
Sin.
Yod is the letter of spirituality. What would the spirituality down here be?
Soul.
The soul, right? It would not be your body. That's physical. It would be your neshama, your soul. Or, remember when I got the Southern Californian glasses and looked at the chair and could see the spirituality, the beaming of God's will giving rise to the atom, molecules, and electrons, so the beam would be spiritual, the wood and the plastic would be physical. Got it? So let's say down here, the lower level yod is your soul. Up there, the upper level yod is God sitting on his throne. The meaning of life according to Judaism is I'm here to use my free will and take my soul and make decisions which connect me back to God. What keeps me from doing it? The mask of nature which hides God. First 6 days of creation, right? That's the bub, doing its job. In other words, I'm here to connect to spirituality, but I can't do it because I keep running into the mask of nature with its physics, chemistry, and biology. I can't access that spirituality up there because God's hiding behind a mask so thick that maybe he's not even up there. That's the first 6 days of creation doing its job. That's what's generating my free will. That's that slanted bub. Now, from what I understand, and I know there's over 2,000 sects of Christianity, but from what I understand that There's an approach that Christianity espouses that if you can take that if they allowed me to speak on their behalf, which they don't, and if they understood the Hebrew alphabet, which they don't, they could say theoretically that mask of nature with its physics, chemistry, and biology can be so inherently blocking and so inherently corrupting that there's a way to access high-level spirituality if you can take that mask and thin it down as small as possible and make it much easier to get past. And therefore, the approach would be to a man, don't marry a woman, sexuality is way too distracting, marry God, forget about fancy outfits, fancy cars, fancy houses, go to a monastery, wear a simple, robe and a simple meal, simple bed, meditate and pray. Take that mask of nature with its Corvettes and its, limousines and Club Med vacations and fancy houses and fancy jewelry and fancy whatever, and squeeze it down small so that you can get past it easier. And for a woman, don't marry a man, sexuality is way too distracting, marry God, go to a convent, simple robe, simple bed, acts of kindness, meditation, whatever. Take that mask of nature with its shopping and whatever, and squeeze it down small to get it, make it easier to get past. And you know what Judaism says about their approach? They're right. You don't have to be a Torah scholar to realize that if you stay away from the shopping centers and the Rolls Royces and all these things, of course, it's easier to take that mask which blocks you, squeeze it down real small, and get past it. We say that method works, but we say you're not supposed to do it. Why? Because there is a misconception here, and that is that the mask of nature that God created is so inherently blocking and so inherently negative, it's going to be extremely difficult to get past. And we say, one second, if you have enough Torah information as to how to use a mask properly, that mask was designed by God. It's not negative, it's just a mask. A mask is a mask is a mask. Who's to say it's negative? In other words, there's nothing wrong with the car, or houses, or vacations, according to us, if you have enough Torah to use it properly. For example, if I take a, no offense to anybody in the room, I'm just going to pick cars, but if I take a $20,000 Toyota, so what's wrong with that? You know, you could say you should buy American, but let's just use a $20,000 Toyota. So I could take my wife out to dinner, I could take my kids to school, I can load the trunk with food for the poor, I can go visit the sick. A car's an amazing thing. What do I have to be scared of a car for? I don't have to be afraid of a car. A car can be used for great things. However, what if I pay $100,000 for a BMW? So what did I pay the extra $80,000 for? So the advertisers say, for better transportation. But that's not true. I mean, you can't visit the sick faster in a BMW. The speed limit is the same for the BMW and the Toyota. You can't get more food to the poor in the BMW. The trunk's the same size as the Toyota. Can't take your kids to school better. You know, they fit in both. So what did I pay the extra $80,000 for? The Torah says, you paid an extra $80,000 for your ego. And the Torah says you can't do that because you can't buy your self-esteem and you can't buy your ego in a car dealer parking lot. That's ridiculous. You have to base your ego on what type of person you are, what kind of decisions you make, how you interact with other people, not what you own. So in that case, I am being blocked. The BMW can block my ability to connect with the Almighty because I'm defining myself in the wrong way. It's no longer fixing up the world. It's actually a distraction, so to speak. So at that point, what we say is, the mask of nature which hides God, when you use it correctly, is not negative. If you have enough Torah to use the mask properly, the Almighty hid himself behind a mask where it actually becomes a method of connection, right? The mask of nature can be a method of connection, meaning the Christian world is actually approaching the Vav as that inherently blocking mask of nature which hides God. And we say, one second, not so fast. That Vav has another definition. The same mask that hides God, literally, that Vav is a hook. It's the conjunction and. The Almighty says go out there in the physical world and use it to connect to God. And that's why we don't go to monasteries. We use the mask with enough Torah that it becomes the vehicle for taking the Jewish people and making that connection. And that's why in the first 60 seconds of the class I kept saying the Almighty keeps using the Aleph as words which take you to low potential and raise you to a higher level. Right? Remember 1,000, leader of a nation, education, all these other words of Aleph are always low potential to a higher level because when you use the mask properly, it stops blocking you and becomes the method for connecting. Vacations are amazing things. They can make you a more patient husband and father. There's nothing wrong with vacations according to Judaism. You have to use the mask so it doesn't block you in a connection. That's the meaning of life according to Judaism, and that's the shape of the letter Aleph. Okay? Just for fun, I'll show you how it works and lines up with the name of God. This name of God, the infinite one, this infinite perfection of God outside the system, is spelled in Hebrew with a Yud, a He, a Vav, and a He. This is the four-letter name of God that we don't pronounce as spelled. We scan it with our eyes. We actually say a lower-level name of God on top of it. Here's the lower-level name of God. Right? Now, the reason I put dashes in is because you're not allowed to erase it. So by putting dashes in, it's just so I can erase it. Okay, so you mentally take the dashes out. But this name of God was actually only pronounced accurately by the priest in the temple when the temple existed 2,000 years ago. But the rest of us just scan it and say a lower-level name on top of it. That's this name right here. Okay, everyone familiar with it? It's in the Shema, it's in all the blessings. Fine. So this name of God has a very important mystical mathematical value. Yud is the 10th letter of the alphabet. He is the 5th letter of the alphabet. Vav is the 6th letter of the alphabet. And He is the 5th letter of the alphabet. You add up the value of this infinitely one, infinitely perfect name that represents that name of God, and you get the value 26. Whenever you see 26 is in Judaism, you always have to think that infinite one, the infinite perfection of God outside the system. And that's why the Aleph has an upper Yud, a lower Yud, which are both 10, the Vav is 6, it equals 26. It alludes to that infinitely one, infinitely perfect name of God. Now, there's a paradox. Last 30 seconds, so stay with me. I know the beepers are going off and the cell phones are buzzing, but there's a paradox, and that paradox is as follows. Listen very carefully. The Almighty hides himself behind a mask of nature to generate your free will with the hope that you'll use your free will to bring his oneness out into the world. But you see, if he comes out into the world without you using your free will, he'll ruin your free will, and then you can't use it to bring his oneness out into the world. Did you follow that? It's a cycle. He has to hide himself to give you free will, with the hope that you'll use that free will to bring his oneness out. Unfortunately, if you don't, he can't come out, so to speak, because he'll ruin your free will, and therefore you can't bring him out anymore. Got it? You see the cycle there? Good. If you got that, you got the word Aleph. You got the word Aleph. Because why? Because Aleph is the first letter of the alphabet, has a value of 1. Lamed has a value of 30. Pei has a value of 80. Add it up, and it's all oneness. The Aleph is about giving that oneness its expression out in the world. When you use your free will properly, you can take God's oneness and bring his oneness out. That's the mystical meaning of the first letter of the alphabet. All the letters of the alphabet work according to the system. They all hold their value in every word of the Torah, including people's names and including the names of locations. And there's no other text on the planet that works like this. That's the hope that I get, that you'll investigate deeper as to whether or not God gave Torah to the Jewish people in that time. Okay? Thanks for having me.
Well, we